as we're grossly unrepresented in all white legislature and town governments.
Well, answer both of your points, madam. First, as to the gentleman who drove the car when I drove in. He's not mine. He's the college's.
I see. Well, I don't think he's still enslaved, so he wouldn't be yours in any case.
Yes, ma'am. Secondly, I'm sorry, but I don't agree with you that that the interests of minorities will be best served by supporting the Arab embargo on some theory that they're a colored race seeking justice from white races. Right now,
that's how I feel myself.
Madam, please, if you allow me to speak, I allowed you to speak as much as you wanted.
Well, you had 15 minutes, I only have two.
I'm sorry, madam, but you just look behind you and you'll see how many people want two. It's like you do. So we want to be fair. Now, the point, madam, is this, that the people who will bear the greatest burden of this embargo are the colored races, black races, yellow races, because the developing countries, and they represent two-thirds of the earth, really can't pay this bill. And they have no choice but to do without oil, because their only source of supply in the main comes from these areas. So
they were not using it because they are underdeveloped. We were using it because we developed, and you didn't answer the other part, if you please.
Yes. Now, as to the other part of your question, just remind me what that was. As to the voting rights, yes.
Grossly unrepresented,
yes. You will be better represented because the courts, acting under a law which I joined in sponsoring, the Voting Rights Act of 1965,
I appreciate that,
has required a reallocation of representation. And though I deeply feel that we ought to have early primaries, that's my classic position, I must accept this year a somewhat later primary precisely for that reason, so that an opportunity may be given to redistrict pursuant to a decision of the courts which has just been made.
And it will affect Suffolk County.
It will, I believe.
I thank the Lord
thank
for
you.
That.
Thank you.
All right.
Senator, my name is John Gilardi, Jr. I reside in Merrick. I'm not a paid representative or advocate of any group or business. But I would like to say, sir, that I have been seeing figures that just don't agree with your figures or the conclusion that this is not organized by the oil companies. The figures in the financial sheets disagree with the figures coming from the government, from Simon's office, from the Petroleum Institute, and from the oil companies. And I know, for example, sir, that we have several hundred independent oil companies on the island that are going out of business and who will not be saved by any investigations. They'll not be saved, and we're going to be left with five or six distributors, just as we're left with five or six bus companies, and they're going to parcel up this island and set their prices to suit themselves as soon as they've disposed of the independents. And I respectfully, sir, ask you why you have not publicly or on the floor of the Senate asked for an investigation of the Justice Department as to why the Justice Department has failed to institute antitrust proceedings against these giant oil companies who hold this country by the neck in a death grip and who, in my opinion, are perpetrating a rape of the American people unparalleled in its history.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir, and let me answer you as follows. In the first place, we'd be glad to have your statistics, whatever they may be. If you'd be good enough to see one of my people here and give them your statistics, I'll certainly investigate them very carefully.
I'm sorry,
secondly,
Senator.
Secondly, we are investigating every element of this, including the Justice Department, beginning Monday morning. As I just stated a minute ago, that examination will be very widespread, and I will be a party to it. And it is entirely proper that any American agency, including Justice, be called upon to answer in respect of these antitrust matters. Finally, and very importantly, on the Long Island situation, I do not believe that your forecast is likely to be realized, because we simply won't let it be realized. The fact is that these wholesalers and their resulting dealers on Long Island have had an overdependence on imported oil. And that's the way in which they got into business. And some of them are very big. And the imports into Long Island are very extensive. Now, the customer, to wit, the individual householder, and there are literally tens of thousands, perhaps as many as 500,000, cannot be permitted to suffer because these people have effected a reliance upon an unstable source of supply, nor can we allow them to be put out of business with the resulting engrossment, to use a legal word, by the large companies of the whole enterprise. In the first place, be impossible to make the shift in time to keep people from being frozen this winter, even if you allowed it to happen. So we propose that the federal administrator will bring about, by the use of his mandatory power, a reallocation of supplies so that the many sources of supply, known as independent, will be able to service their customers. And it will interest you to know that as recently as this morning, I had that matter under review with the administrator of this area for the Federal Energy Office, so that I'm not telling you something that just is, again, forensic. So I can assure you and assure the people here that action will follow these statements of policy which I have just made. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, I invite you to listen to yourselves. I've been at this long enough, and I've served long enough, I think, to be able to speak this way. I invite you to listen to yourselves. The statements of this gentleman were greeted with great applause. It only bears out what I told you before. We are in the gravest danger of kidding ourselves into thinking that somebody's cheating us, instead of understanding that I'm sure there is cheating, but there's also a crisis. And so I hope very much, notwithstanding the applause by which I'm not a bit intimidated, that you, just like I, will understand our responsibility to continue effectively a conservation program. Whether there is or isn't a crisis, in your opinion, it still is essential if we're not to suffer the worst. On the chance that there isn't, we won't suffer so terribly if the heat's down to 68 degrees. And on the chance that there is, we'll suffer really, really seriously and badly if we defy our own precaution, our own prudence, by thinking that, well, they're just cheating us, and so we'll go ahead in the good old way and run down to the corner drugstore in the car five times to buy a paper, aspirin, a Band-Aid, or a toy for the children. Now, I beg of you, and my purpose here would not be serious if I didn't, I beg of you, think it through, and I hope very much that you will take very seriously what I say, notwithstanding your applause, which I predicted. You will recall when I spoke, because that's the prevailing sentiment. And I think it represents a really serious danger to the people themselves. Yes?
Yes. Senator Javits, my name is Hal Curtis Felcher. I represent the Claremont Polychemical Corporation, located in Roslyn Heights, Long Island. We manufacture chemicals which are used by the plastics industry throughout the country. Our business has been sharply curtailed. We've had to lay off people due to the unavailability of raw materials. Could you tell me, sir, what is the cause of this shortage of raw materials? And if you are aware of the situation, what is Washington trying to do to remedy the situation?
I am very aware of the situation, and it's covered by the points made respecting whether there is or is not an oil shortage, because this is a derivative of oil. But Washington, as you call it, is now prepared to allocate supplies to users of petrochemicals, where it translates into employment. And that will have an equal priority with vehicular supplies and lubrication supplies to business. We've ascertained that, we've nailed it down, and we'll follow through on it. So that if you have a case and a complaint, a particular company in a particular situation, turn it in. That's what we're here for. And we'll see that you get satisfaction, if you're right. And I'm sure that's the way you want it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Jack Brennan, Senator, and I am a businessman who does a great deal of traveling in the Northeast Corridor. I have a report which I hope your assistant will take down. On the morning of December the 17th, 1974...
Well, hold it a minute, would you? Would you listen to this, please? Go ahead.
It took me something like 12 hours to get from Syosset to Philadelphia. That evening, December the 20th, 1973, at 30th Street Station, there were four Metroliners canceled. I came to New York behind the standard GG1 locomotive. I was 30 minutes late and there was no heat. Last night, Metroliner 120 was 50 minutes late. The conductor told me that the equipment assigned to that train was canceled at the last minute due to brake trouble. These are some of my more recent experiences using Amtrak service in the Northeast Corridor. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And if you'd be good enough to come up and give your address so we can reply to you when we get the facts.
Thank you.
I'm Carl Grossman from the Long Island Press. Your invitation to us for this thing said questions from the press would be invited. Representative Roncalo...
You didn't have to stand online.
I think I should. Representative Roncalo charged during his walk to Cold Spring Harbor the other day that the United States Senate didn't act on that bill which contained the excess profits provision because a large number of U.S. senators have received contributions from segments of the oil industry over the years. I'd like to ask you, one, to comment on this, two, just to clear the air because you indicated you'd like to in this respect. Have you ever, in your years in politics, received contributions from the major oil companies or from these independent wholesalers on Long Island you talk about? And an unrelated question, perhaps, if you could answer it, do you think the energy shortage that now constitutes justifies drilling of oil offshore of Long Island?
Well, on the first question as to contributions, every contribution I have ever received has been published, including the smallest, including subscriptions to any dinner which was run for the benefit of any of my activities. So all you have to do is consult the lists, and frankly, I just don't know. Secondly, I have never accepted a corporate contribution and never would. I think that's about all I can tell you as to that, and I'm certainly not influenced by the oil companies. I'm deeply confident of that. Finally, as to my colleagues in the Senate, I think the best proof is in the eating. I believe that the bill will pass within a few days after we return, and that one or two senators, with whatever was their own special interest, to which they're as much entitled as anybody else, they were elected just like I was, felt that they didn't want to let the bill go through that last day. It was just one day that separated the situation. We had already passed the adjournment resolution, and the House had gone, so there was no going back on that. So it simply had to wait until we come back, and I'm confident that if there is a filibuster, it will be broken by a cloture vote, and that we'll have the bill promptly. And that's the best proof, because I just can't tell you otherwise, except that the law requires that other senators, like I, publish everything they get. And I assume it's been done. But in any case, in my case, it has been done. As I say, the passage of the law, I'm confident it will become law.
What about offshore oil drilling?
The offshore, yes, I'm glad you reminded me. I believe that that is a question which somewhat depends on the ecology. I would not wish to jettison everything we've done about the environment under cover of the crisis. We may have to go a little easier on it, or a little slower, maybe. But I certainly wouldn't anticipate that in the first instance. So I would wish to have the findings on the ecology as well as the necessity for more oil before lending myself to any proposed exploration off the coast of such a heavily populated area as Long Island.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
My name is Kenny Shahabi, and I'm from Seaford. There was an article in Newsday yesterday, and it said that, referring to November specifically, whereas the American Petroleum Institute and William Simon and the Federal Energy Commission had all said that there was a decrease of oil imports into the United States, and they based all their information on the American oil companies. that the U.S. Customs Bureau, which had gotten all their information from actually shipping records, said that there was an increase of oil imports into the United States over the month before, and that the discrepancy between that report and the American oil companies was like 19 million barrels. Now, I would kind of be more likely to believe the U.S. Customs Bureau than the American oil companies. And I think the problem more than that is that the U.S. Customs Bureau records have been public for 3 weeks. And William Simon has been able to see them for 3 weeks, but he's completely ignored them in all his statements and has still been going only by the information here from the American oil companies. Now, you said he kind of welcomes cynicism, and I don't want to be too cynic about it. But I saw a special on TV a couple of weeks ago. It was on NBC News, and it was about the Phillips Oil Company in the Midwest. And they said that the former president who had retired in March was just indicted for making illegal contributions to Nixon's campaign. Now, I know that Simon and the whole Federal Energy Commission are all from the Nixon administration. Like I said, I don't want to be too cynical, but it sounds a little bit suspicious. And it's not a far cry to guess. I mean, Nixon has been going along with this whole thing, too. And I don't think it's a far cry to say that he might be repaying a few favors from the American oil companies for the exorbitant contributions they might have made to his campaign.
Well, to cut my way through the what you have said, which is opinion, and what you've asked in the way of fact, I'd simply like to say this. One, the American people are entitled to all the facts, fully verified, and we don't have to take the Petroleum Institute's word for it. We were stuck with the Petroleum Institute's figures because we had no others at the given moment that we started. You might as well ask me in the course of a trial whether after the first day the defendant is guilty, and I tell you I don't know. But I will tell you that we'll go through with the trial and that we'll afford the necessary law to see, and we'll do it all promptly. This is a big deal, and we'll move right into it. And we will see that the opportunity for chicanery, if any, has been practiced, is not repeated. As to the difference between the Customs Bureau and Simon's figures, frankly, I don't know. I think it would be a mistake to consider Simon some kind of a creature of the interests. He comes out of an important banking firm in Wall Street. He's always enjoyed an excellent reputation. And what we've seen of him looks quite good as an able man and an honest man. Finally, may I say this. One possible, I don't know that it is the explanation, but one possible explanation of the bulge in imports is a bulge which I favor very strongly because the embargo took effect on a given day and a rush effort was made to get the maximum amount of supplies before that day came. And I hope there was a bulge. I'm delighted if there was, because that enabled us to have a little more reserve than we have today. And when you look at Con Ed's figures, with 8.5 days reserve, it gives you a cold chill. That's much, much, much too dangerous and too little for a city like New York.
Yes? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Joe Scandera, 516 Lombardi Boulevard, Brightwaters, Suffolk County, Islip Town. There's only a couple of questions I want to answer you, Senator. There's nothing more I could add that you have repeatedly very nicely. As a senator for the past 20 years or more, I've been your follower for quite some time. Number one, you are a constitutional man. You believe in the Constitution's rights. And I'll say one thing is this here. Two questions I want to give you right now is, what answer could you give on Ralph Nader comments? Two, I am with a committee that I am going down to Washington, D.C., which I have written you quite a few times for the right to life. I wish and hope that your colleagues would, at one, amend to the Constitution to have a referendum for the right to life. I thank you.
Mr. Scandera, first, thank you for your support of me. I hope it survives this meeting, which I greatly appreciate. And two, I haven't been in the Senate for 20 years, but I will be if you reelect me in 74. But to answer your question specifically, first, as to Nader's observations, I'd answer them exactly as I answered the young man before. That is, that we've We must treat him with respect. He has certainly earned his spurs in the public service. That doesn't mean he's God either and can't be wrong. But his inquiries have been made. He testified before the committee I referred to last Monday, and I will be sure to dig into them, into all the allegations he's made. As to the right to life and the abortion controversy, it is a very profound one. I have the deepest respect and regard for people who feel as you do. Personally, I have not taken that position, and I have just as deep a conviction about my views as you have about yours. So with mutual respect on that one, I'm afraid we can't get together. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name's Chris Visco. I'm a student, and I'm studying geology. First, I'd like to say I have a terrible feeling that you, Senator Javits, and all legislatures like you are guilty of the same thing. You thrive on a crisis.
Could you, sir, stand a little away from the mic? It's hard to hear. Yeah, go ahead. I'm guilty of something.
You are. I think you're guilty of thriving on a crisis. Now, geologically, this oil crisis didn't start this year or last year. The oil is a finite resource, the Earth's surface. You know, it's not going to grow any more than we have it. So we've had this crisis. Now, all of a sudden, since prices are going up, you legislators are responding to our people. Why don't you respond to our needs before? Why did this crisis have to start? I mean, you says in 1 year, using conservation and using our domestic supplies, you can get rid of this crisis that we have. But how can you? You want to go out and get oil shale. You want to get the remaining coal that remains in the United States. Do you realize what that entails? We have to strip mine to get that coal. Look at the ecological damage. Shale oil, that shale is bound chemically in the rock. The cost of getting that oil out is greater than the cost of getting the oil itself. What's the sense? Don't you care? Why not? This money you want to spend on research and exploration for future oil supplies. Why not spend this money on future resources such as atomic energy or solar power? I think we're digging ourselves in an endless hole here. The more we go on oil, the more we're going to depend on it. And we have to face the fact that it's going to run out.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I tried to avoid this boring business of justifying my own record, but there are a number of questions on it, so I simply will have to do it, but I'll try to do it as briefly as possible. First, as far back as 1970, I joined, indeed, marshaled 20 other senators to see if we could get authority for the overland transportation of oil imports from Canada, which were then embargoed. And I was unsuccessful, but I certainly was alert to the emergency. That's almost 4 years ago. And following that up with an effort to bring about the building of a new refinery in the northeast United States, with efforts to bring about a meeting to concert their plans of all the nations who would be adversely affected by a diminution in the oil supply from the Middle East, as far back as a couple of years ago. So as far as my own record is concerned, you're not throwing me at all. And I'm not guilty, and I'm not to be indicted for that. Now, as to the state of the world, which is infinitely more important, the fact is that we had run down our oil reserves in terms of oil, which was selling, roughly speaking, at the rate of $3.50 a barrel, and that we were getting to the bottom of the barrel, so we had to impose what's called proration on most of our oil extractions in order to save what was available at that price. Now, the people of the United States should not have been called on to pay more of a price if you could get imported oil at a price which was less than we could extract it from the ground. So we avoided greater costs by importing a lot of oil, and the curve of our imports was due to go up remarkably for that reason. In 1970, we imported 14 million barrels per day of oil. In 1972, we imported 16 million barrels per day of oil, and by 1980, because of that situation, we were going to import 23 million barrels of oil a day. Now, the price, therefore, we didn't make it. The Arabs had simply held us up.
You know, it costs only 10 cents a barrel to get it out of the ground in the Arab countries. And when you add the transportation and taxes and everything anybody can dream of, it's still less than $3.50 a barrel. So we're being held up. We're being blackmailed. And the result of the blackmail is that we're going to dig deeper and more expensively. There's no question about it. Oil will be more expensive, even domestic oil. And we're trying in the price control mechanism to crank in to the increased price only that percentage which represents the increased price of exports, rather of imports, because we're still getting imports from Nigeria, Indonesia, and Venezuela, and we want to continue that. And they, too, have taken advantage of the going world price. So my feeling is that we have to explore more, we have to become more self-sufficient, that we'll bring the price down from what it is today, which is roughly close to the $10 mark per barrel, but that we won't bring it down to what it was, even out of domestic production, because it's simply more expensive than what it was before. Yes?
Senator Javits, my name is Manny Goldstein. I represent several small business firms in Long Island. These firms are manufacturers for the federal government, and they have fixed price contracts and are caught in a trap with spiraling prices since last year, with raw material prices as well as petroleum products. They cannot absorb the losses. Now, there are provisions under Public Law 85804 to increase contract prices, but this provision takes 6 months to a year to negotiate. I was wondering if anything could be done to expedite this process and to provide, rather than fixed prices, escalation clauses in contracts with the federal government.
As to escalation clauses in contracts, we have to be very careful about that. It can be done by agreement between the supplier and the government, but in view of the fact that government is always under the danger of being taken in terms of dishonesty, etc., the standards are generally more rigorous for government than in private enterprise, and that's endemic in the situation. Somewhat the same answer is true as to the length of time it takes to adjust. Again, government has to be super careful to avoid fraud, bribery, imposition, etc. Not that it avoids it. There's lots of it. But nonetheless, you've got to make every effort you can. However, we are ombudsmen, these gentlemen and myself. Our job is to deal with crisis situations or serious emergencies where adjustment must be expedited. Therefore, and that generally depends on whether a man really could be forced out of business if his adjustment was not expedited. So my suggestion is that where a contractor has a case which deserves expedition, that it be taken up with one of us, his local congressman, his senator, who can and should intercede in those cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Runhild Wessel. I live in Hicksville. I have a question about the national health insurance bills that are now up before the Senate. It seems to me that from what I have heard and read, that the Kennedy-Griffiths bill seems to be the most comprehensive. Would you please comment on that?
You had another name in the House with Kennedy. What's the name? Kennedy? Which
bill? I believe it's the Kennedy-Griffiths bill.
Oh, Griffiths. Kennedy-Griffiths
yes.
bill. Yeah, I will comment on that. The Kennedy-Griffiths bill is a bill for national health insurance which is backed by the AFL-CIO. There are many other bills, including my own. I don't think the Kennedy-Griffiths bill is any great national disaster. In other words, it's a perfectly feasible and intelligent plan for national health insurance. My own bill, however, relies more heavily than does their bill upon the existing suppliers of various types of services, endeavoring to make them meet a given yardstick rather than to go so heavily into the establishment of essentially government agencies for the purpose. Again, I think under my bill, there will be greater encouragement to existing private enterprise plans, many of which are great, like, for example, the classic Permanente plan out in California.
more so than under their bill. But I can assure you that I am favorable to national health insurance, that I will cooperate at the earliest time in getting such a law passed, and that if necessary to do so, I will subordinate my views to that of Kennedy Griffiths or any other bill that's reasonable in intelligence that has a chance.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, good afternoon, Senator Jarvis. I take a different position. All of our...
Just stand away from it a little bit, sir. That's it. Go ahead.
A different position.
Yeah.
That we've had 11 years to make up, and I stand for the mothers of the nation, the mothers of the world. We have murdered people in Indochina, and I have friends all over. 15 trips around the world. And how many of you here can say it? 9 3-quarter trips. And I don't know how many trips, and I broke bread in India. I broke bread everywhere in the Far East. And your country sit back and let groom and aircraft supply it. Work material, work material to eat your society. And I pray to God the world takes us into the earth. And they will. I saw war in World War II. And that Congress, you sit up there 127 out of 435 in 1969. Yeah, where's Lynch here?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, sir. Sir. I think your 2 minutes have expired. I'm sorry, sir. Your 2 minutes.
And your labor union.
Yes, sir.
And I founded one in 1936. Yeah. Let's get on all our knees and pray to God the world will forgive us. And I talk for the American Medical Association. I talk for all who mothers.
Yes, sir. Yes. Okay. Would you just step up, sir? Yes, sir. Your question. Sir, you've had your 2 minutes. Thank you very much, sir. Yes, sir.
Don't tell me about Richard Milhouse
next. Thank you, sir.
He's nothing but a punk to me.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Don't tell me.
Okay. Next questioner up there.
Senator. Yes.